Welcome, everybody. This is the first of four lectures of a relatively short course that we're offering on the sovereign debt crisis. As you know, of course, that's been in the news. That's one of the things that people are citing as for why U.S. stock markets are having such a volatile ride the last few weeks. So in this course, well, I don't know, I'll go ahead and just advance to the course description, explain what we're going to be covering. So I'm an economist. I was trained as an academic economist. I've worked somewhat in the financial sector, and lately I've been following financial affairs. But mostly I am coming at things from the angle of economic theory. All right. So a lot of what we're going to cover in this course, it's not going to be these events through the lens that, say, an investor would look at it, or even a government official perhaps, but it's mostly going to be through the lens of various economic theories, right? So primarily it's going to be the point of view of mainstream sort of neo-Keynesian economics, or new Keynesian, I should say, economics on the one hand versus the Austrian perspective on the other. Having said that, this opening lecture tonight is going to be mostly just a bunch of various facts just to make sure we're all on the same page, because we're going to see there's certain, I don't want to say myths, but I think when you hear different people offer a narrative to explain what's going on, a lot of times it's not that they're lying, but they might present the facts in a certain way that would give you an impression. And so it's good in this introductory lecture here just to lay out a lot of the facts and make sure we all understand the big picture before then later on in the course we try to figure out exactly what's going on and why is it that all of a sudden it seems the world financial markets are very concerned about a few of these countries defaulting on their debts and concerned about the fate of the euro and things like that. I think probably most of you have had me for one of these online classes before, but if not, let me just give a very quick explanation. So every Wednesday at this time, which is 6 Eastern, I will start and give the lecture, the main lecture for that week, and I'll typically go about an hour and 15 minutes, and then the remaining 15 I will field your questions, which will be posted. If you go to the Moodle forum for this class, each week there will be a thread called Questions for the Professor. So that's where you should post your questions when you're doing the reading, or even during the lecture, if I say something that you need me to elaborate on, don't put your questions in the little chat box, because I'm not going to see them, because there's too many people posting there and talking to each other. So if you want me to field a question at the end, you put it in that Questions for the Professor. The other benefit of doing that is if I don't get to it, you know, we run out of time and I have to stop before I answer everyone's questions, if your question's sitting there, then I have a record of it and I can come back to it. I'm thinking probably for this class in particular, a lot of your questions I'm not going to know the answer to off the top of my head. You know, so if somebody says, hey, what was the European Central Bank's rate of base money growth from 2003 to 2006, I don't have that information at my fingertips. I can't just tell you the answer, right? So I'll have to go, I can look it up and I can answer for you, but you got to give me time to go get the exact numbers, right? So that's the kind of thing, that's why I encourage you, if you have questions, put them in the specially designed place for it for each week. What else? There's office hours on Saturdays, and I'll announce those near the end of the weekend approaches. I'll send out an email. You should be getting emails for this class. If you're not and you want to, let somebody know. If you have questions, Danny, do I tell people to just use the TA address, or is that just for me to use? Okay. So, yeah, if you have any kind of technical question, like, hey, I can't log in, or, you know, geez, my video keeps freezing, or I'm trying to watch the videos after the fact and I can't download it or whatever, stuff like that, use the email address ta@mises.com. TA, short for teaching assistant. The live class is only once a week, Sarah. So if you miss any of the live lectures, they're recorded, and then you can just go and download them after the fact. A lot of people do that knowing full well that they're never going to make the live lecture. Last thing I'll say before we get going in the main material tonight, if you want to, you can take the course for credit. And the way that works is every week there's a multiple choice quiz that you take by logging into your Moodle account and, you know, clicking on this course, and you'll see where the quiz is posted, and it's pretty self-explanatory. And I will send out an email blast telling you when the quiz is going to be open. You'll have typically about a full week to do the quiz. All right, so this is week one. Tomorrow I will post the quiz to open up on Friday, and so I'll send you an email right before that happens, and then you'll have through next week's Thursday, late Thursday, to complete quiz one for week one's material. Generally, you're going to be better off if you do the readings before the lecture. All right, so this for this course, I'm giving you a bunch of different readings, and it's going to make a, my talk's going to make a lot more sense if you've already read it beforehand. Okay, and then finally, if you're taking the course for credit after the four multiple choices, for, you know, four quizzes for each week, at the end there's a final exam. But I will explain all that stuff if you're taking the class for credit. If you're not taking it for credit, you don't need to tell anybody. Just when you aren't taking the quizzes, we'll figure it out that you must not want to take the class for credit. Okay, so I'm going to spend a bit of time talking just about the U.S. housing bubble, because I think a lot of the lessons or points from an Austrian perspective would carry over to discussions of the housing bubble in any of the countries. But so what's might be unique for some of you who have followed my writings on the housing bubble in the U.S. is that we're going to, you know, then broaden our perspective later on in the lecture to include the entire global market and to see that it wasn't just a U.S.-based phenomenon. This was a global housing bubble. But having said that, there also, of course, was a very significant U.S. housing bubble, and we'll explain why in a few minutes. I'll explain why I think it's worthwhile for us to really focus on the U.S. case and what we think as Austrians was going on in the United States. So let me turn on my pointer here. Okay, so this is showing the house price index for the U.S. There's various indices you could use, and they show different things, but the general picture is the same, that housing prices in the U.S., they started accelerating upward in the late 90s, but then they really took off around 2002, 2003. Then they peaked late 2006, thereabouts. Depending on which index you look at, the timing is a little bit different as to when the bubble started bursting, but they're all basically the same, and then they came down quite significantly. And this, of course, is just the U.S. average. If you looked at the bubble in smaller markets like Las Vegas or Miami or certain cities in California, you would see an even bigger boom and then bust. All right, let me point out a few facts, because you might be surprised that I'm even taking the time to do this, but there are actually some economists out there who dispute the connection between the housing bubble and the economy. Like the fact, some economists, I should say, challenge the notion that we have to, as economists, explain why the housing bubble and bust happened to talk about the current recession, because they think that the two really had little to do with each other. So I want to just show that that's not just something we assumed, that if you go and you can look at various things to show that, of course, there's a very close connection between the housing bubble and the broader economy, and that to understand why did the U.S. all of a sudden face an economic crisis, first the recession, then later on the actual financial panic, a good place to start is to say, well, what the heck was going on in real estate? Why was there this big housing bubble? All right, so in this chart, what I'm looking at here is the blue line is construction employees measured by thousands, so that's on the left axis. So it was hovering around 6.8 million, and then it took off in the mid-2000s there and reached a peak up here of about, 7.7 million. All right, so that's an increase, 900,000. So that was how many new workers were pulled into construction from other sectors. And then, of course, it crashed. And what this red line is, so if you just remember what the bubble from the previous slide looks like, you can see that Well, yeah, that makes sense. That as prices were zooming up, more and more workers were getting sucked into housing, which makes perfect sense. And vice versa, once the bubble burst, workers started leaving. And actually, there's a bit of a lag. If you had superimposed those two lines, then you would see the home prices started coming down earlier, and then the employment crashed, which also makes sense. We won't get into that, but if you think it through the logic of building houses and then building malls and things to accompany the new residents and new neighborhoods and so forth, it makes that lag kind of make sense. Well, what's this red line? This is showing the home vacancy rate. And so that goes along with the right axis. So you can see in these years, the home vacancy rate was around 1.8%, and then it started steadily rising and peaked up here at about 2.8% or so. So in terms of standard economic theory, to explain, what do you mean when you say there was a bubble? Does a bubble merely mean that prices went up? Well, no. That the underlying fundamentals, if you will, of supply and demand could have shifted. If there's, let's say there's a lot of immigration, or let's say the birth rate went up, or let's say people felt richer and were just moving out earlier. People who used to be living with their parents now are moving out earlier, or people just wanted to live in bigger houses because that became the new fad. It was a status symbol, whereas before it wasn't as much of a status symbol. You could offer all sorts of reasons to explain why you could shift to a permanently higher level of home prices, and that wouldn't. So the fact that the price was rising more rapidly than normally, that by itself wouldn't prove that there was a bubble. Now, the fact that the price rose unusually rapidly and then crashed, that of course for a lot of people is indicative of the fact that there was a bubble. But even there, I mean, you could tell a convoluted story that, you know, well, gee, if like a bunch of immigrants came in and then there was a plague and they all died, and so the population rose 10%, 10%, 10%, and then crashed 30% in 1 year, maybe then home prices would look like they did in the earlier chart, and that wouldn't have been due to any sort of irrationality or speculation. It just would have been the fundamentals were whipsawing around. Okay, so what I'm doing with this red line is to try to show using economic theory that this is exactly the sort of pattern we would see if there really were a speculative bubble, meaning that home prices were being bid up not because the underlying fundamentals of supply and demand had changed significantly, but they were just rising because people thought they were going to keep rising. So people were buying houses not to live in them, but to use them as speculative investments. They were buying homes intending to just resell them later on at a higher price. So if you think through what sort of empirical evidence would you see if that were going on, well, you would see the home vacancy rate rising, the percentage of homes that existed that weren't being lived in. And so that is exactly what we see at the peak of the housing boom, that home vacancy rate went way up. All right, so again, you may think that why do we need to go over this stuff, but it's just because a lot of economists are challenging the Austrian story about what happened in the U.S., and so I just want to show you that we're not just assuming all this stuff, that you can go through and document a lot of these things that may seem like common sense, and it is common sense, but economists are notorious for denying common sense. Okay, another connection, again, just to make sure that you see this stuff, is we're not just taking it for granted. The financial markets were closely intertwined with the housing bubble. So whether they were both caused by the same underlying factors or whether one was driving the other, you know, this graph doesn't tell us that, but it does show us that there certainly seemed to be a strong correlation between the housing bubble, this blue line, what was happening with the home price index, and what was happening in the stock market. This is the S&P 500. So again, all this stuff, I'm just giving empirical support for why Austrians, when they're trying to explain the recession, are going to focus on monetary policy and how that fueled the real estate bubble and then the fact that the crash happened and that's when the recession started and so forth, we can see that the trends in employment and underlying financial sector are all closely related to what was going on in real estate. Okay. We had some other people challenge the connection, because of course where the Austrians are going with this is that we're going to blame it on Alan Greenspan, or so we're going to say more specifically that monetary policies under Alan Greenspan's Federal Reserve were excessively loose, and that helped to fuel the housing bubble. So one of the things that people have said to try to refute the Austrians is that they'll say, oh, well, there's, you know, what Greenspan was doing, you know, with interest rates, where that doesn't really explain what happened with home prices. And actually, that's, I don't even know why they say that. I think that's a case of where they just make up stuff. That looking at the slide here, so what's this red line? The red line is the annual increase, the percentage increase in the home price index over the past 12 months. Well, actually, I think this is quarterly data. All right, so over the past year. So you see here at its maximum, and it's the right-hand scale, it was almost a 20% increase, more like a 19% increase. Okay, so what that is saying, right, that's not when home prices peaked. That is the quarter at which home prices were rising the fastest. All right, that's what that means. So if you look at this red line, I just want to make sure you know how to read this chart. Home prices didn't actually peak until this point right here. Well, even though that's technically right, right. At this point, home prices were even with where they had been 12 months prior. So actually, they peaked a little bit earlier than that. Okay, and then from that point onward, because now we're below the 0% line, that's showing you once you get into this date range, home prices were lower than they had been 12 months earlier. All right, so what's this blue line? This is just the standard rates on a conventional 30-year fixed rate mortgage. So you can see in late 2000, they were as high as 8.5%. And they just steadily declined down to a low summer of 2003, around 5.25%, just eyeballing the chart there. And then they were bouncing around, but they generally started back up again. And so you can see that that's coinciding exactly, you know, when these things were low, that's when home prices really were taking off. And then as mortgage rates started rising again, that's when home prices slowed their ascent and then at some point peaked. And the thing is, I ran the numbers on this for an article on Mises.org, and just using standard models of economic behavior, where when somebody buys a house, you know, they figure out what would be the annual rental payments or mortgage payments if you want, and then you work backwards and say, okay, various mortgage interest rates, how much should you be willing to pay for the house right now? So that if interest rates go down for a given monthly mortgage payment, that means the current present value of the house can go up. You can afford to buy more house. So if your budget allows you to spend $1,000 a month on your mortgage, well, if interest rates are up here at 8.5%, then you can take out a much smaller mortgage than if interest rates are down here at 5.25%. All right, so I'm going to get what I'm saying, that as interest rates go down, purely as a matter of just being a rational economic calculator, for a given monthly mortgage payment, you can now afford to go buy a bigger house. And so that's what really surprised me when you had some economists challenging the Austrian story on the grounds that interest rates really don't have anything to do with home prices. And what are you talking about? Of course they have something to do with home prices. And anyway, here's the data to show that they do, but just standard economic theory. You don't have to be an Austrian to know that lower interest rates will lead to higher capitalized values of durable assets like a house. Okay, so we got that down. Now, another link in the Austrian story, if you want to say that this is at least partially the fault of the Federal Reserve, is you got to, okay, well, how do we know that Alan Greenspan had anything to do with those interest rates being low, those mortgage rates being low? Okay, so again, I'm just walking you guys through various challenges to the standard Austrian story about monetary policy and the housing bubble in the United States, at least. Okay, so we've seen the housing bubble certainly seem to have a lot to do with the real economy, and we've seen that home prices certainly do seem to have something to do with the fact that mortgage rates dropped very quickly and then rose again. So now again, people have challenged the Austrian story and say, okay, sure, we agree with you, all that stuff. Yep, real economy was tied to the housing bubble. Mortgage rates, you know, 30-year mortgage rates, sure. If those go way down, home prices are going to go up. If they start going up, home prices are going to crash. No problem with that. But we just dispute you Austrians who blame this on Alan Greenspan. Fed can't control long-term interest rates. All right, so we're going to walk through that. So here we see this black line is the federal funds target. So this is what the press reports when they say what the Fed's doing with interest rates. You know, they say, oh, the Fed today left interest rates unchanged at between 0 and 0.25%, or in earlier times that they said, oh, the Fed lowered interest rates today from 3.25 down to 3%. They're talking about this black line here. That's what that is. The federal funds rate, specifically, it is the interest rate that commercial banks charge each other for overnight loans of reserves. Okay, so it's a very short-term rate. So you can see, if we want to make a case against Alan Greenspan, the federal funds rate was at 6.5% here, and then because of the recession that was kicking in, the dot-com crash, and then the 9/11 attacks, Greenspan's Fed started lowering short-term rates all the way down to 1% by June of 2003. And then it held them there for a year, and then in June of 2004 started steadily, basically every time the Fed met, they bumped up interest rates a little bit. So they got them way back up here. All right, so notice, so look at the pattern there. So it's I think that's in either late 2000 or early 2001 when they started lowering rates. They bottom out in the summer of 03, stay there for a year, and then start going up. So if you look back here, mortgage rates were high in late 2000, came down. When did they bottom out? In the summer of 03, and then they started going up again. Okay, so it doesn't, you know, short-term interest rates and long-term interest rates did move somewhat in the similar patterns. And then you say, and people say, oh, well, that's not that, you know, the Fed was just following the market. That was just supply and demand. People have said that, right, that it wasn't the Greenspan was dictating what was happening. He was just passively accepting whatever the market was throwing at him. Well, look at what happened to monetary base. Okay, so this blue line is monetary base growth. This is year over year. So you can see, and that goes with the left-hand chart. That's what the L means on the legend there. So this humongous jump up and then jump down, that's because of Y2K. That right before the Y2K switchover, the Fed pumped in a bunch of monetary base to make sure everybody was okay. That they weren't going to panic, there wasn't going to be a liquidity squeeze, and then once they got through it and the world didn't blow up, planes didn't start falling out of the sky, ATMs still worked, then they quickly sucked that excess base out. So that's what that huge swing is. But other than that, you can see when short-term interest rates were plummeting, what was Greenspan doing with the monetary base? It was growing at a sizable clip, at more than 10% year over year. And then when he wanted to start raising rates again, what happened? The growth of the monetary base dribbled down. So that's, I mean, just textbook, you're trying to explain how does the Federal Reserve influence short-term interest rates. That's the story you tell. When the Fed wants to push down interest rates, it increases the rate of money growth. And then when it wants to ease off and let interest rates rise, it pumps in smaller and smaller amounts of new money. Right, so that's entirely consistent with this graph. And then you want to say, some people have said, okay, well, sure, yeah, the Fed created more money when rates were falling and the Fed eased off when rates were rising. But in the grand scheme, come on, do you really think that monetary base growth in the range of 10% can explain this humongous housing bubble? Like, just does that seem like a big deal to you? Well, we can look at this chart, and you can see that the monetary base growth here in the early 2000s, you know, up above 10%, go look back in the 1970s. And never in the whole decade of the 1970s did monetary base growth ever get that high. And in case you think that there's some disconnect between the monetary base and M1, which is a different measure, I put that in there too. All right, so these people, and it was like Jeffrey Rogers Hummel, who's a free market guy. He may even be an anarchist. I don't know for sure off the top of my head. I think he is. All right, so, but he was defending Greenspan, saying, no, the Austrians are wrong. Greenspan didn't cause the housing bubble. And one of his arguments was just, you know, sort of smell test to say, come on, look at what Greenspan did with the money supply. You're telling me that's enough to explain the housing bubble. What he did was fine. So I generated this chart to tell him differently and to say, look, okay, if you're saying that what happened with the monetary base during the housing bubble years when the boom really took off isn't a big deal, well, then by the same token, you can't blame the stagflation of the 70s on monetary policy. You have to say it was because of the Arab oil embargo or something, or because unions got greedy. But most free market people will blame the high price inflation of the U.S. on excessively loose monetary policy once the U.S. went off the gold standard. So my point is, if this blue line here or the black line, whichever one you want to use, is reckless monetary policy in the 70s, well, Greenspan was doing just as reckless stuff in the early 2000s. So it's not odd the Austrians are going to point to that and say that's largely what was going on with fueling the housing bubble. Let me just say one thing. You might say, whoa, but wait a minute. There was a lot more crazy stuff going on like in the mid-80s and then over here. Right, that's true. And then, but notice right here, this drop off here, there was the 87 stock market crash right when this thing went up and then down, which was the worst stock market crash in world history, worse than in that 29. So our story, the Austrian, still makes sense. You know, in other words, you could say, well, if your story were right about the housing bubble and stagflation, then you'd have to explain why there wasn't some huge financial event in the mid-80s, but there was, the worst stock market crash in world history. And then also, you know, here, this huge boom, well, you know, I haven't looked at those numbers carefully, but you could argue, well, there's a huge tech bubble we're trying to explain too, right? If we go back to the stock market chart right here, you know, in the late 90s, big tech bubble that burst. So again, it's the fact that there was this big surge in the monetary base, over here in the early 90s, that by itself doesn't mean our theory's wrong. You just have to say, well, does that explain the tech bubble? Okay, another argument people will use against the standard Austrian explanation of the housing bubble is they'll say, no, it wasn't because Alan Greenspan was printing a bunch of money. It was because there was a global savings glut. And so that's what pushed down interest rates. So they might agree and say, yeah, you guys are right. The fact that interest rates fell so much in the early to mid-2000s, that does explain the boom in other asset markets, right? That people were looking for yield. That's what people will say. That, yeah, because they were getting such paltry returns on short-term safe assets, they started going into real estate. They started going into other sorts of derivatives, and that's what happened. So that explains why people got so risky, why they took such big risks. And then it just, you know, was a self-fulfilling prophecy. Once those assets started booming, everybody started piling in and so on. But ultimately, the culprit was this global savings glut. That you had a bunch of foreigners who were just saving too much. There weren't enough investment opportunities that drove down interest rates, and that screwed everything up. Okay, so I totally reject that hypothesis for two reasons. One, that just strikes me as crazy that we're going to blame a worldwide financial catastrophe on the fact that Asians are saving too much. That doesn't make any sense to me. That, no, savings is good if it's genuine savings, and that's what these people are saying, that if only the people in Asia would have spent a bigger fraction of their income on going out to eat or buying sports cars, we would have averted this financial disaster. But since they tried to save it and be responsible, that's why the global capitalist system came to the brink of failing. To me, that just sounds crazy. But if you don't like an argument from faith in capitalism, you can look at this particular chart. And this chart, by the way, I got from a paper arguing for the savings glut theory. Right? So these people think that this chart shows how right they are, when I just look at it and say, what, are you crazy? So watch. So we're looking at this blue line. This is showing the percent of GDP that emerging and developing economies are saving. So the person who constructed this chart, what did he think he was showing? And these are showing investment in the same economies. So the person who constructed this chart thought he was showing, look at, you see how this gap is growing between saving and investment in these emerging and developing economies. So what was happening is these countries had to put their savings somewhere. So they started dumping them in the U.S. and other places. And that's when they dumped them, started dumping them into real estate. You know, they started buying U.S. treasuries and things that pushed down yields. And so just interest rates across the board were dropping. And eventually they needed to put it somewhere, so they started investing in mortgage-backed securities and so on. Also, this influx of foreign saving reduced returns for everybody. So then even domestic hedge funds that were using domestic money had to go in search of yield and dabble in risky stuff. Okay, so that's what the person who made this chart thought it was showing. But I want to say, okay, wait a minute. You're trying to explain why there was this big boom in asset prices in the early 2000s. And then the mid-2000s, and then why it suddenly collapsed. And your theory is that it's because of foreign savings. But wait a minute. You can't see it as well here, but if you look at the actual numbers, you can see it better. The average from 86 to 93 is this level. And then the average from 94 into 2001 is actually a little bit lower. All right, so that's a little bit weird right there, that, you know, when the housing bubble really starts developing, the global savings percentage is lower, and they say, okay, fine, and then it starts rising, so you can say, all right, so maybe that's prima facie evidence as to why it could have, you know, fueled the housing bubble, but then it keeps going up, and it tapers off and goes up, but it didn't come down, is my point. So it just seems odd that you're explaining this huge move up and then crash by reference to this independent variable that was actually higher before the phenomenon started, and then just kept steadily rising up throughout the boom and the crash, and then leveled off. Okay, so that's why I don't. Whereas for me, when I want to blame it on Greenspan, I can show you this kind of thing and show that, well, no, you know, things went down as this started going up, and then they started going up as this thing went down, and then I can tie it to quite specifically what was going on at the monetary base. So both in terms of just raw theory and, you know, common sense to say, does it make sense that foreigners saving a bunch ruin the world economy, by just looking at the data, I don't think that's a very good explanation. Okay, moving on. Let me just fill in the gaps here from some things that you should know, because this, you know, the readings you're going to do and just the chatter and people discussing things, I want to make sure you guys know these basic concepts. So what would you mean by mortgage-backed securities? Very quickly, and it's too bad we don't have the capability of doing the animated PowerPoints, because I took this from a different talk I gave. It's actually, I had all the stuff moving around. It was kind of neat. But so what was going on, and I'm giving you the quick dumbed-down version, of course. So you had commercial banks would give mortgages to individual home buyers. You know, so a couple wants to buy a home, they'd go to their local bank, get a mortgage. But then you had thousands of these mortgages from all over the country, and the commercial banks would sell them off to investment banks, hedge funds, and so forth on Wall Street. Then it was these, you know, big firms on Wall Street, they would bundle them up and put them into pools of mortgage, of what were called mortgage-backed securities. And then they would sell pieces of those things off to individual investors, many of whom were overseas, and many of whom were like asset managers, like people who are managing retirement accounts and things like that. Institutional investors is the term I was looking for there. So what would happen is, in this issue of, and this gets into the ratings agencies, and everyone's all mad at them now. So what would happen is, in case you're wondering, how could it be that people thought these things were AAA? How could they, why did they think that these things were so safe? It's because this is the way it worked. You weren't buying an individual mortgage. Everybody knew an individual home buyer could default on his mortgage payments. He could lose his job, get sick. If the real estate market in his city crashed, he might just realize he was so far underwater, he walks away and just strategically defaults. Right? So everybody knows there's a lot of risk with an individual mortgage. But the supposed beauty of these mortgage-backed securities was they would take thousands of these things and put them into a common pool. So every month, let's say there's 1,000 of them. All 1,000 people are supposed to be making their mortgage payments, and all 1,000 payments flow into a common pool. And then out of that, different investors would buy what were called different tranches. So the people who had the safest thing, they were the last ones to take a hit. So in other words, they were being promised a certain monthly flow of income or cash flow, I should say, out of this pool. But the way the contracts worked, it said if we suffer default, you know, if some of the money doesn't come in every month that it's supposed to from these mortgages that we own, well, if you want the real safe tranche, you don't take the hit first. First, we, you know, this guy down here, he's buying the really risky tranche. So he takes the hit, you know, let's say, you know, the first 50 people who default, that comes out of this guy's cash flow every month. And then the next 50 comes out of this guy's, and so on, all right? I'm just making those numbers up, obviously, but you get the idea. So by slicing and dicing the rights to these potential cash flows coming from the original home buyers, the Wall Street firms could make these assets, these derivative assets, look more or less safe. So if you were buying the really risky thing that was like the top tranche that was going to take the hit first, you would pay a small amount, but because you had the promise of a large gain, right? If it just so happened that very few people defaulted, you would be getting in a ton of revenue or a ton of cash flow for compared to what you had put up originally, right? So you had the potential for a high rate of return, but on the other hand, depending on how many people defaulted, you might not see anything. Whereas the people who were buying the AAA stuff, they thought they were, you know, very safe. And so what, in case you're curious, part of what happened here, part of the reason everything blew up in everyone's faces is just it was an intellectual error. So, yes, there's monetary policy involved and so on, but another thing that was going on with all this is the Wall Street firms and the rating agencies were far too optimistic about the safety of some of these apparently secure tranches because they would, what they did when they were modeling it, you know, they had to make assumptions and have a computer simulation to see under various scenarios what's the likelihood of this particular investor not getting his money back. And then if they ruled that, oh, there's no way that's going to happen, then the thing would get AAA. So what was going on is they were, in their modeling of the real estate markets in the United States, they assumed that the local markets were independent of each other. So they said, you know, they might say, I'm of course making these numbers up, but they might say, all right, we all know there's a chance that in Miami, real estate prices could go down 10%. You know, it's happened before, it could happen again. It might happen, and then we know if that were to happen, a lot of people would be underwater, they'd walk away from their homes, they'd strategically default, blah, blah, blah. So we got to take into account the fact that there could be a drop in the real estate market. And so then they would say, all right, what's the probability of that happening, of home prices in Miami falling 10%? What's the probability of them falling 20%? And they would say, oh, the data center, like, you know, let's say it's 1 in 1,000 that they drop 20% in 1 year. Okay. And then they say, all right, what's the chance that in Nevada, in Las Vegas, real estate prices there are going to drop 20%? And they'd say, well, that also, you know, could happen. Let's say it's 1 in 1,000. All right. Then they would say, okay, suppose now we have a mortgage-backed security that is made up of 500 mortgages from Miami and another 500 mortgages from Las Vegas, and we have an investor who's only going to take the hit 501 people default. Okay, so as long as just one of these markets is okay, this investor is not going to take a hit. So what's the probability that real estate prices in Miami and Nevada at the same time go down 20% or whatever number I said? And they would say, well, those are independent events, so it's 1 in 1,000 times 1 in 1,000. That outcome will only happen 1 out of 1,000,000 times. And so they said, okay, this investor is totally safe. You know, we'd have to wait 1,000,000 years before we would see an event that would cause you to lose, to not get your promised monthly payment. Okay, so you guys see how that works? So I'm, obviously I was making those numbers up. I have no idea what the probabilities were. And they didn't just do it in two cities. They had these things drawn from a bunch of cities. But the point is, the crucial assumption they made that turned out to be wrong is they thought real estate was local. They thought if something happened in the Miami real estate market, that you know, there couldn't be some single cause that would make home prices across the country all drop simultaneously. That's what they assumed, and that, well, we don't know if that was right or wrong, but what just happened, their models were saying that kind of thing should happen once every 100 million years, something like that. So maybe the model was right, and we just got really unlucky, or maybe that assumption was wrong. Okay, credit default swaps. That's another thing floating around that you should know what that means. So it's the standard way to explain this stuff is to call it an insurance policy. So the idea is that, let's say AIG, for example. So AIG, American General Insurance, they were a standard life insurance company. Like, I actually think right now my term policy is still with AIG. But they also had a financial products division, and so they would sell credit default swaps, or CDS. And what that would do, so let's say I'm an investor and I have a bunch of bonds from General Electric. All right, so I lend money to GE, so they issue bonds, they want to borrow money from the public, they issue bonds, I give them money. Now I'm sitting on a bond issued by GE, and the bond tells me every month they're going to send me whatever, $1,000 in a coupon payment, and then at the end of the term of the bond, they're going to give me my principal back. So those interest payments are going to flow, and then I'm going to get my principal back. Now, I might be worried, well, what if GE defaults, and they either delay their payment to me, or they just don't pay me outright because they go bankrupt and I get nothing. I want some protection for that. So I can go to AIG and say, I want a credit default swap on GE bonds, so I will pay you, AIG, a premium, and you are insuring me against a credit event, which would include GE, you know, delaying their payment to me or just completely walking away from it. And so then AIG would make me whole in case GE defaults on its obligations to me. just like if I'm, you know, having a fire, if I have fire insurance on my house, I pay a premium, and then in the event that that bad thing happens, I get made whole by the insurance company. So it's the same kind of principle here. I pay a premium, and then in case there's some financial event that hurts me, I get made whole. Now, the thing that's funny about credit default swaps is you actually don't have to be hurt by the event. So I can buy credit default swaps on GE bonds even if I don't own them. And so people have said that's kind of weird. It's like if you're buying fire insurance on your neighbor's house, that if you just kind of think that your neighbor's house is going to get burned down, you could sort of bet on that by taking out a fire insurance policy on your neighbor's house. And then people, you know, push the analogy and say, so just like that would be a little bit weird, because then you might wonder, are you going to try to burn down your neighbor's house, or do you see something coming and you don't warn your neighbor because instead you stand to profit from it? By the same token, a lot of cynics are saying they don't like this whole credit default swap thing because by buying credit default swaps, you might be encouraging the very thing, or if you knew there was bad information about a firm and the market was overvaluing it, that was one way you could sort of like short that company. Besides literally shorting the stock, you could buy credit default swaps if you thought they were going to have trouble making their bond payments. All right, so anyway, but that's what was going on. So AIG got in trouble because they had issued, and to clarify, it was AIG's financial products sector or segment that was in trouble. It wasn't their standard life insurance business. That was still fine. That's still up and running. And like I said, I think I just wrote them a check, actually, for my premium. So, you know, it wasn't their life insurance division. It was the division that was dabbling in this financial sector stuff. So what happened with them specifically is they had issued a bunch of credit default swaps, and then the counterparties got nervous as the real estate market was going down, as you know, various investment banks were getting in trouble. The counterparties got nervous because they stood to lose a lot because of the deteriorating economy. And so they were worried that AIG wasn't going to be able to make them whole, right? So let's say you go back to the original example. I had lent a bunch of money to GE, and I'm sitting on these bonds, and now I learned that, oh, man, GE's had a few bad quarters. They're laying people off. Uh-oh. And then, you know, I start to worry, that are they going to be able to make these bond payments? So then I thought I was doing the smart thing, and I took out a bunch of credit default swaps. But now I learned that, uh-oh, AIG is in trouble too. Or not that AIG made bad investments per se, but I look at some of the numbers and wait a minute, AIG has sold credit default swaps on GE, on Ford, on, you know, all these other companies that are at risk to a bunch of other people. And there's no way if GE goes down and Ford goes down, all other companies go down, AIG can't possibly pay everybody off. And so that was the concern. So a bunch of the credit a bunch of the AIG's counterparties, the people who had bought credit default swaps from them, were asking AIG to put up more collateral to assure them that, okay, they can pay us off if they have to, and that's what actually killed AIG, is they couldn't put up the collateral. So it wasn't actually that they were on the hook for payments that they couldn't make. It was that the people holding those credit default swaps got nervous and then demanded they put up collateral, and they couldn't do that. You know, they didn't have the liquidity to do that, and that's why the Fed came in September of 2008 and took them over. All right, if you're interested, if you want to see more about this stuff, because we really can't spend much more time on it, you can look at this article here that I wrote for the Freeman. If you're just listening to the audio of this, it's just Google Freeman Robert Murphy. Did deregulated derivatives cause a financial crisis? And I'll go through and walk you through that stuff there if you want to see the details of this. This thing over here on the right, that's actually showing the CDS spreads for, I'm having trouble reading it right now. I think it might be Portugal, Spain, and Italy, but I'm not sure. Maybe Greece is in there. I just can't read the Bloomberg readout. But anyway, that's one of the things, because you can have credit default swaps on sovereign debt. And I should probably clarify in case people don't know that. So sovereign debt means debt issued not by a private corporation but by a sovereign government. All right, so bonds issued by the Greek government or by the Spanish government or by the Italian government, if investors are worried that those governments are going to default, they can go to a private institution and buy credit default swaps on those things. And so then you can see what is the level of fear about default. One of the things you can do is looking at, well, what price are these insurers charging people to insure bonds issued by the Greek government? Because obviously if it's a bigger risk of default, you have to pay a higher premium. So by looking at the movements and the prices of buying credit default swaps for, you know, $1 million worth of debt issued by the Greek government, how much do you have to pay as an annual premium to be insured against that, default against that? You can look at the price of that over time to see what the market's expectations were. So that's what this chart is showing, and that's, you know, when you're reading pundits talking about this stuff, that's what's going on. Okay, well, let's move into the worldwide housing bubble. So we've talked about the U.S. one. So first, let's do the country comparison. So here we're going to try something risky, not as risky as buying Greek debt, we hope. I want to show you the that tool that I'm listing here that The Economist put up. So I'm going to try to share my desktop. We're not going to do it for very long, so I'm hoping that the audio still works and whatever. But worst case scenario, if something gets screwy, I'm going to come back in a minute. But what I want to do is show you how to use this toolbar. Okay, so I'm sharing the desktop, looking at The Economist's home price indicators, and that buzzing is just the you guys chatting. Okay, so let me clear all this stuff out. What else is here? Okay, so you can see here the U.S. Bubble, home price bubble. So it's going from 2000 to 2011. All right, so if it starts out at 100 in 2000, it went up. You can see it went up to, I'm just eyeballing the chart here, about what, 60, 70% increase, and then came back down a little bit. So let's look at some of these other countries. Unfortunately, not all of the at-risk countries are on this thing, but we can look at some of them. So we'll look at, where is it? So Italy. So you can see Italy was actually more pronounced than the U.S. That, you know, their bubble was rising faster, and then it went even higher, but then didn't fall as much. Look at Spain. Well, that was a big one. South Africa is huge. We're not going to be talking much about South Africa. You can see Spain, really big. Ireland, almost as big as Spain. And then Portugal and Greece are not on this. All right. Okay, so my point here is, we know how bad the housing bubble was in the U.S., and that was actually not as bad as it was in Italy. Ireland was even worse, you know, even more pronounced, and Spain was even worse. All right, so it depends. When you talk about worst, I mean, the increase was bigger, of course, and then the issue is as well between Spain and Ireland. You know, Ireland bubble crashed much harder, so you know. Depends how you want to define works. So in Spain, the bubble got pumped up faster and higher, but it didn't come down nearly as much, whereas in Ireland, you can see just absolutely catastrophic. In contrast, you can see like Japan, pretty low. Let's see, what other ones? So Australia went up, but didn't really level off. And then, like Canada, you can see that's pretty tame in comparison. All right. So anyway, you can play with that thing if you want. Look at various things, perhaps earlier dates to look at whatever you want to figure out. Okay. Okay, so now I'm back here. Okay, can you, so you guys, could you hear me when I was talking and walking through that thing? Okay, great. Well, that's a good experiment then. All right, so let's move on. Now, what some people will say is that, will say, okay, you Austrians, you know, you're so eager to blame the Federal Reserve for everything. So I've already dealt with all those other objections, right? That, oh, it's, you know, the real economy has nothing to do with the housing bubble. Talked about that, about the link between the housing bubble and the stock market, the link between mortgage, you know, interest rates, and then finally to say, well, maybe the interest rates were driven by foreign saving rather than monetary policy. All right, so we've dealt with all that stuff. Now, another one, another argument they'll use that actually, you know, at first I wasn't sure how to respond to, is people will say that, you know, guys, this was a worldwide phenomenon. All right, so how could it possibly be the fault of the Federal Reserve that, you know, interest rate, or sorry, that home prices in Ireland went through the roof and then crashed? How is that Alan Greenspan's fault? That he can, yeah, sure, he can control, you know, if you want to argue that he caused the U.S. housing bubble, okay, but that doesn't explain the global housing bubble. And then once you realize it was a global phenomenon, you start to think, okay, the answer has to have a global solution, or the explanation has to be a global one. And so that's, I think that's partly why a lot of people were drawn to the global savings glut hypothesis, is because they thought, they're thinking those terms, that, look, if it needs to be, if we're trying to explain a global housing bubble, then we, our independent variable or explanatory variable, whatever you want to call it, has to itself be something that's global. It can't just be U.S. monetary policy, or it couldn't be Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, which a lot of conservatives like to blame. Let me just spend, we got a little bit more time here than I, we're a little bit ahead of schedule, so let me just talk about that for a second. A lot of, in case you guys don't know, foreign people, so let me type this thing out. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. So those are what was called GSEs, government-sponsored entities or enterprises. And they, before this crisis, they were nominally private corporations, but everybody knew that they were politically favored, all right, that they had been set up by the government, you know, through special legislation or charters, and they had an express purpose to facilitate people getting into homes who otherwise would not have, right? And so if you went and looked at their mission statements, I mean, that's what they were supposed to do. That was their whole point of having these things. It's because the idea was, in a cutthroat, pure laissez-faire environment, a lot of poorer people, people who, you know, didn't have good credit, who maybe just historically didn't have a lot of assets and things, just a lot of disadvantaged communities, that sort of thing, just would have trouble getting mortgages from commercial banks if those banks were just making a pure cutthroat business decision and didn't take into account sort of broader social goals. And so the idea was, we don't want to just leave the allocation of savings to potential home buyers up to market forces, because that's a cruel outcome and there'll be disparities, that all the money will go to the rich white neighborhoods and not to the disadvantaged minority neighborhoods. And so the federal government established these things partly to assist in that. And there was also this thing called the Community Reinvestment Act, or the CRA for short. It was actually established under Jimmy Carter, but then under Bill Clinton, he strengthened it. And if you go look at the numbers, there is a kind of correlation between when Clinton strengthened that thing and when you really see the bubble and home prices take off. Okay, so so a lot of right-wing conservative Republican types, when they were trying to explain what happened, they were pointing at these things. And they were saying, oh, well, duh, if the federal government is trying to force banks to give loans to undeserving borrowers, we shouldn't be surprised that these banks make a bunch of bad loans. And that if Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are there, and what their specific role was, is they would buy mortgages in the secondhand mortgage market. And so the idea was commercial banks would be more willing to give loans to particular borrowers if they knew that the banks could then sell the mortgages off to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. All right, so Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac wouldn't literally give you a mortgage, but they would stand in the background ready to buy mortgages, and so commercial banks would be more willing to give you a mortgage. And so the standards that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac set up, a lot of commercial banks just adopted them, that they knew, oh, if we have incomes, you know, stated incomes in this range, credit score such and such, the appraisal value is this much loan to value, blah, 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 Fannie Mae will buy this loan. So we'll make it and get it off our books because Fannie Mae will buy it. And then we'll get the processing fees and all that stuff. Okay, so that's what was going on here. So I agree with Tom Wood's take on this in the book Meltdown, where he says that, yeah, these programs could explain particular distortions, but by themselves, they really can't explain this enormous, huge surge in asset prices that, you know, drove up this Wall Street and drove up the whole real estate market across the country and then led to a huge crash. That, you know, that really wouldn't explain the housing boom and bust. So the more nuanced Austrian version is you still need to have the Fed there pumping in money that then has to go somewhere and screw with asset prices and cause bubbles. And then, yeah, maybe Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and the Community Reinvestment Act, that might explain why that stuff happened to get channeled into housing. And those things may have made the housing bubble more severe than it otherwise would have been. But by themselves, Woods was arguing, you could not have seen this huge housing bubble. All right, and I agree with his analysis there. So anyway, back to this particular slide. So another thing people will say is, how do you explain the worldwide housing bubble? It can't be Fannie Mae, it can't be Freddie Mac, it can't even be Alan Greenspan, because it's a worldwide phenomenon. So there's a couple points to make. So one thing is, look, the U.S. dollar is no mere currency. It is the global reserve currency, right? Ever since Nixon closed the gold window in 71, the U.S. dollar has been the world reserve currency, meaning other central banks use dollars the way that the U.S. used to use gold, that other central banks pyramid their own fiat money on top of dollar reserves. So if you're a foreign central bank, yes, you can still hold gold, and now in the recent crisis, more and more of them are stockpiling gold. But before this crisis happened, the dollar was considered an incredibly safe currency. And so the idea was, if you were a foreign central bank, one of the things you would hold in reserve would be dollars or treasuries denominated in dollars, to show that if there was a run on your currency, you had dollars backing it up. And so that was one way that you would control interest or exchange rates and keep investors and speculators from worrying about your particular currency. Just like in the days of the classical gold standard, if you had a bunch of gold in the vault, people wouldn't bother trying to short your currency because they would know that you can back it up, that, you know, the exchange rate wasn't going to move significantly because you can just pay out gold. All right? So that's one thing in the story that makes the Austrian story plausible, is to say we're not saying it was the Central Bank of Zimbabwe that caused the global housing bubble. Yeah, that would be silly. Because, yeah, we know that the guy in the Zimbabwe central banker was printing way too much money. And but that explains why he ruined Zimbabwe's economy, why there was hyperinflation in Zimbabwe. That doesn't explain why the Miami real estate market took off. But it's not as absurd to say that because Alan Greenspan was printing a bunch of money, that that's why the Irish real estate market took off. Right? Because the dollar, again, reserve currency of the world, but also that, you know, New York is a far more important financial center than the capital of Zimbabwe is. So it's and the other part of that too is a lot of these investors in the mortgage-backed securities in the U.S. real estate market were themselves foreign individuals or investment banks. So there was a lot of interconnection going on just on those terms. But let me give you some more supplementary information. So ECB stands for the European Central Bank. I saw some people asking that. So in late 2000, their deposit facility interest rate, which I think is analogous to the Fed's federal funds rate, so like when you're saying what would the ECB do with interest rates, this is the number that I think the press reports, that stood at 3.75%, and then they steadily cut the rates down to 1% by June of 2003. So if you remember, the Fed started at a higher level, but it's the same pattern. They started cutting at roughly the same time, and they both brought their rates down to 1% by June of 2003. Now, the ECB actually held the rates at 1% until December of 2005, so longer than the Fed did, and then they started steadily hiking them, reaching back to 3.25% by July of 2008. All right, I was trying to get you a graph of this stuff, but I couldn't figure out a way to generate it. I was, you know, looking at the ECB's website, and they had a, you know, they had the numbers and the dates of when they made the interest rate change, but I couldn't get it into a nice graph. So that's why I just typed it up. All right, so what's my point here is that if you bought the story I told you before about the Fed causing the U.S. housing bubble by bringing interest rates way down and then hiking them back up, and that's when the crash started happening, you could tell a similar story with the ECB, that the only main difference is the ECB never had its rates as high as the short-term U.S. interest rate. But it's the same basic story, that they started cutting rates, and then when they bottomed out, that was precisely when at least the U.S. home bubble was really going further, and so on. So there's various reasons you could give for that, whether they were operating independently of the Fed or not. I think probably one of the things to keep in mind here is if there's big interest rate differentials, then that sets into motion currency arbitrage plays, right? So if I see some questions in the comments. So the ECB, I mean, they're formally independent. They can do whatever they want. But my point is, what they were doing was the same pattern as what the Fed was doing. So it doesn't, how can I put it? So the Austrian story is still okay if we're blaming the U.S. housing bubble on Alan Greenspan's loose monetary policies and the fact that he brought interest rates down. You can't say, well, what about, you know, why would the Spanish real estate market have anything to do with the Fed's policies? So at the very least, I can say, well, no, it's the ECB did similar policies. So if you bought the loose money story for the U.S. to explain it in the Eurozone, it's the same thing. Their central bank brought interest rates down too. All right. But the connection there goes a little bit further, that I'm not saying, I don't think it was simply that Greenspan and the leaders of the ECB were throwing darts at a board and just happened to randomly lower interest rates at the same time. That I'm saying, given that the Fed did what it did, that put other central bankers around the world in a pickle. Because if they kept their rates high, then what happens is investors want to move capital into their country. So I'm speaking loosely here, and for I know there are some professional traders involved, and let me say this caveat. Of course, I'm an academic economist who's only recently been in the financial sector, so with all this stuff, if you catch me saying something's a little bit off, but please, you know, email me and I will correct that and fix that. I don't want to be saying something that's a little bit off for people who, I know, like I said, we have some enrolled students here who literally trade currencies and whatever. So let me, as an academic economist, let me give you my understanding of this. But you've got, let's say Greenspan lowers interest rates to 1% in the U.S. If in the Eurozone they kept them up at 3.25%, well then you could borrow in the U.S. and lend in Europe and make that differential, so long as you didn't think that there were going to be any major swings between the euro and the dollar. All right, and then you say, okay, well, why wouldn't they want that to happen? Well, if you've got a bunch of, I mean, as a free market economist, I think that actually is fine. And if I were advising, you know, a sovereign nation, like maybe some dinky little island country somewhere, I might tell them, yeah, don't worry about that. Just you keep your free market policies in effect, keep your money solid, you know, tied to gold or something, and don't do what Alan Greenspan's doing. He's an idiot. But I'm just saying, politically, it'd be hard for them to do that, because if your interest rates are high, I mean, when the other ones are low, and you said capital flowing into your financial capital flowing into your country, well, that's a capital surplus is the flip side of a trade deficit. All right, so it makes it hard for your exporters to keep exporting goods and services, well, goods, if you've got a bunch of investors around the world who want to get into your assets because you have higher rates of return. All right, another way of seeing it, which is kind of the same thing, is if your interest rates are higher than some other countries, other things equal, your currency is going to tend to strengthen. All right, so if, I'm going to put you this way, we're initially at equilibrium, everything's fine, we got no trade deficit with anybody. Now all of a sudden the U.S. brings interest rates from 6.5% down to 1%. Your currency is probably going to strengthen against the U.S. dollar. And so that, for your people, that makes U.S. exports cheaper. So your people are going to be more likely to buy U.S. products. And to Americans now, because the dollar falls against your currency, Americans now are going to find your products more expensive. So it's going to be harder for your exporters to sell to Americans. So now all of a sudden, you're going to have a big trade deficit with the United States. And that makes sense, because American investors are going to try to take their wealth, sell off their dollar-denominated wealth, and get into your assets. And so in the international, you know, the currency exchange, foreign exchange markets, they're basically going to be selling dollars against your currency. All right, so this all makes sense, but you get the point. There is, it's hard politically for central bankers to just stand firm while major economies are lowering their interest rates, because it puts a lot of pressure on the little dinky country's export sector. So again, as free market economists, you can say that's fine, that, you know, you're better off doing this, but, you know, in terms of reality, there's a lot of lobbyists and stuff for these major exporters, and it just seems good to promote jobs and whatever to devalue your currency if everyone else is doing it. So that's actually, look, when I was down in Brazil recently, that issue came up, and the Brazilian central bank or government, I forget which entity, made the decision. They had been fighting it off for a while, but they had to let their currency depreciate against the dollar because it was just killing their export sector. So they didn't want to follow the U.S. and Bernanke's reckless policies, but they felt they had no choice, that it was just hurting them too much to keep their currency relatively strong in the face of Bernanke printing money like there's no tomorrow. Okay, so that's one issue here. To see another illustration of this phenomenon, you've got, let me just check and see how many slides we got left. Okay, we just got one more slide after this. Okay, another example of this that I can talk about somewhat knowledgeably is the Fed and the Bank of China. So here, what's going on, part of the story, again, let me just back up, make sure I'm not losing anyone, the big picture. What I'm trying to show you now, and what I'm going to say about China, what I was just saying about the ECB, and what I was just saying more generically about countries that have their own central bank but yet they're minor players in a world dominated by the United States and the Federal Reserve. The point was that if the Fed engages in very loose policy, printing dollars, pushing down interest rates, it puts pressure on you to devalue your currency also, to drop your interest rates, to print more money, to make sure the dollar doesn't strengthen, or sorry, that the dollar doesn't weaken too much against your currency, and to make sure that there's not this huge gap between interest rates in the United States and interest rates in your country. For conventional policymakers in a Keynesian mindset, again, Ludwig von Mises is advising your government, or your central bank. He's going to say these people are crazy, tie your currency to gold and just wait it out. You'll be better for it. But I'm just explaining why a lot of these countries would have gone along with it. So again, the fact that this was a global housing bubble, you can't exonerate Alan Greenspan by saying, well, he can't control what other central banks do. Yes, he can, or he can significantly pressure them. So let me explain now what was going on with the Bank of China. So this shows the exchange rate between the Chinese yuan and the U.S. dollar, and you can see that the yuan was, sorry, how does this work, depreciating against the dollar in this period, but then from this point on, they locked in the exchange rate. Okay, so the Chinese Central Bank, the Bank of China, from basically 1995 onward, and they really solidified, you can see how it kind of bounces around, but they really solidified it in the late 90s, had a pretty strict peg of the Chinese currency to the U.S. dollar. And then only lately did they start letting their currency weaken against the dollar. So make sure you get, you know, if you look at the chart, so this is weakening because now, strengthening because you're getting fewer yuan per dollar. So when the thing goes down, that means their currency is actually weakening. So it's kind of funny. You may not have realized this. With all the press and everything, you may have thought that the Chinese were adamantly refusing to let their currency move, and that's not true. They are doing what the U.S. officials were asking them to do. Okay, but anyway, the point is here, this period, so notice this is right when the housing bubble was in full swing in this area, in this timeline, time frame. So what does it mean to say the Chinese had to maintain a strict peg with the dollar? It meant that if Greenspan is running the printing press, other things equal, that would make the dollar fall against the Chinese currency. So if they don't want that to happen, if they want to maintain a strict peg, where I think it was 8.25 yuan per dollar, what do they have to do? They have to be just as loose. They have to expand their money supply to offset whatever Greenspan's doing. And this also, you may remember, is when the Bank of China started accumulating vast stockpiles of treasuries, and when the U.S. was running a bigger and bigger trade deficit with China. Right, so it's the whole thing of this is just crazy, where so that's what they were doing. The way they were keeping their own currency from strengthening was they had to print more yuan, and so how were they doing it? And so then they were buying dollars with it, right? They had to prop up the dollar against their currency. So how did they do that? Well, they were buying treasuries. So, you know, to do that, you had to take your currency, buy dollars with it, and then buy dollar-denominated treasuries. Right? So that's the way they kept the dollar from falling against their currency, was they kept sopping up huge quantities of dollar-denominated assets. And so, so when people were lamenting the huge trade deficit with China, everyone's getting mad about the Chinese, and all these right-wing hawks were talking about putting tariffs on China, and let's look at their abusive currency policies, and let's, you know, investigate them for pirating software and all this. It was Greenspan printing money that was making that happen. because the Chinese had pegged, I mean, the Chinese, of course, they could do what they want, but the point is they had earlier decided in the 90s that the way they were going to insulate their country from attacks by currency speculators, you may remember in the late 90s there was what was called the Asian contagion, where like Thailand and some other countries had their currencies crash because foreign speculators didn't like their country's policies and thought they were vulnerable. China didn't want that happening. So what did it do? Well, it wasn't backing up its currency with gold, it was backing up its currency with U.S. dollars, thinking that was basically the gold standard in our modern fiat age. And so how do you assure foreign investors that there's no point in shorting your currency? You have hundreds of billions of dollars of treasuries in the, you know, in the vault. And you keep your currency pegged to the dollar, and you make people think it's always going to be there. Just like back in the day, the dollar was tied to gold at a certain exchange rate. So that's what the Chinese were doing here. They were on a dollar standard, not on a gold standard. So just like if you were on a gold standard and all of a sudden there was huge discoveries of new gold that could lead to asset price inflation, well, by the same token, if you're on a dollar standard and all of a sudden there's a huge increase in the amount of dollars in the world, that could screw up asset prices even quoted in your own currency. Okay. Last chart here, and I'll turn to your questions. So what I did for this, to construct this Excel chart, is I went through that economist link that I had given you guys for the debt loads in various countries, and I just marched through and then, you know, filled up this Excel spreadsheet and then charted it. So that what this is showing, I actually forgot to put the title on this. This is public debt as a percent of GDP. And we see here the pigs. I don't know if I've said that yet. So you see people talk about pigs, P-I-I-G-S. That stands for Portugal, Ireland, Italy, Greece, and Spain. So these are the countries right now that people are worried about when they talk about, oh my gosh, what's going to happen with the sovereign debt crisis, and is the euro going to make it? They're worried about these countries in particular. And then I've also got the U.S. here just for comparison. So partly what's interesting, and I didn't even actually know this until I did it myself. I knew some of these countries' histories, but I didn't know all of them with confidence. As you can see that with the let's just look at this, because there's different lessons to be drawn. So for one thing is it's not like with Greece and Italy, you can see they have very high debt to GDP ratios. But it's not that they got high all of a sudden. I mean, with Greece, you can see how it's rising quickly, and that's why, you know, all of a sudden there's this crisis. But even back in 2003, they still had a debt-to-GDP ratio that was pretty high. Right? So it's not that the Greek government all of a sudden got profligate, and that's why they're in trouble. They historically have had a high debt-to-GDP ratio. In fact, you can see it actually fell down somewhat during the boom years. And incidentally, let me just point this out. When you guys are looking at this stuff and you see that some of these countries saw a slight improvement in the boom years, it's not necessarily that their governments were running budget surpluses. It could just mean that their economies were growing faster than the absolute amount of their government debt. And so that would make the ratio go down. So just keep that in mind. It's not necessarily that the Greek government was running budget surpluses in these years. And the same sort of story with Italy. Yeah, right now it's got a very high debt to GDP ratio, but it did back in 2003 also. What other interesting ones? Ireland is interesting. That's this red line. You can see, and that's partly why I gave you that Ben Powell article to skim, is with Ireland, that used to be a free market success story. Okay, and that's part of the tragedy. The same thing with Iceland, too. David Howden in his piece talks a little bit about that. I mean, I knew a guy. This would have been in, it was fairly recent. I want to say like 07. That he was looking for somebody to work for him, and I went and interviewed. It turned out I didn't take the job, but what this guy did is he was this fairly wealthy guy, you know, had a few million dollars under his belt, and he would just trade currencies. And that's what he did. And he was really big on Iceland because he liked the policies they had in place. You know, he could talk to you at length about why Iceland was a really good, stable country going forward, was a good long-term bet. And that's why he was, you know, had various positions in place predicated on the fact that Iceland's currency was going to be quite stable in comparison to other currencies around the world. And obviously that turned out to be a colossal blunder on his part. But the point is, if you believe in free markets and so, like, you could understand why he was saying that. That, you know, he wasn't like a mere technical trader and was just pointing at charts and saying, oh, here we have the head and shoulders, blah, blah, blah. No, I mean, he was giving me very sound, fundamental free market reasons for why he thought Iceland was going to be a great place for investors going forward. And a similar type of story with Ireland, that this, and we'll see in some of the Paul Krugman pieces that we're going to look at later on in this course, Krugman's just having a field day with this. He loves it because you've got the Heritage Foundation, you've got people at the Wall Street Journal, so forth, praising Ireland up until everything blows up. And you can see here on this chart, look at their debt to GDP ratio is dropping. And the Ben Powell piece points out, you know, there was this Irish miracle to be explained. Why was Ireland all of a sudden doing so well? And I still agree with this. It was because they implemented a bunch of fairly, what you call, pro-market reforms. I mean, they weren't Austrian per se. They were more supply-side stuff. But still, when you're trying to explain why did their economy do so well all of a sudden, you can point to very specific things they did that would be consistent with, you know, a free market approach, you know, lowering marginal tax rates, getting their spending under control, that sort of thing. So that's partly the tragedy in Ireland. You can see how it was going down, and then all of a sudden it just goes bonkers in the last few years. And that Vanity Fair piece that I asked you to read, let me just encourage you to read that in case you're wondering, I'm not going to read some tabloid article. It's a pretty good piece. You know, they give you the good history. It's kind of fast-paced. The fact that it's 22 pages, it goes quickly. They're not big pages. You can get through it pretty quickly. But I would encourage you to read that if you haven't already, just to see the magnitude of the debts that the Irish government guaranteed for its private banks. All right, and that's partly what's going on here, why their debt went up so much. It's not that all of a sudden the Irish decided to, you know, go on a massive stimulus program. I guess the only other thing here that I was actually surprised to see was with Spain. You can see their debt to GDP ratio was coming down and then zoomed up during the crisis. So partly you need to know this so that you can understand later on people like Krugman. He's going to try to explain away all this stuff is due to the recession. And the same thing with the United States, where the U.S. is this orange one. You can see it was fairly flat for a while, and then the U.S. debt to GDP doesn't really start zooming up until a crisis sets in. So Krugman's point is he's going to try to say this is not about fiscal irresponsibility. It's not that these countries, you know, had bloated welfare states and were just racking on public debt year after year and finally caught up with them, and, you know, the credit card company cut up their cards. He said that's not what's going on here. It's that this crisis set in 2007, 2008, and then these governments were in a bind, and then they started running up debt because their tax revenues collapsed and their social safety net spending went up, and some of them engaged in stimulus programs, and that's the issue here. All right, so that's I'm partly showing you this just so you can understand what Krugman's rhetorical point is. Because it's true, a lot of sort of Wall Street Journal type right wingers who don't know or who only recently have gotten on the anti-Fed bandwagon, they've been trying to explain this stuff just purely in terms of fiscal policy. And so they were trying to put out the narrative that, well, yeah, if you run big budget deficits, you're going to get punished by international investors. And the point is that doesn't really explain why Greece or Italy all of a sudden are in such big trouble, that, you know, they had huge budget or huge debt ratios even back before there was any kind of issue of a crisis. Okay, so let me turn to your questions. I went a little bit over that. Well, I used the full time, but also I'll answer your questions for another 10 minutes or so, assuming you have them. got to log in. Incidentally, while I'm logging in here, in case you guys are wondering, why do I have so many pieces from Paul Krugman for this course? There's two things. Partly, I read him religiously, and so I just, in terms of me having access to and knowledge of a mainstream sort of Keynesian view on something, he's the guy that I know most closely. But the other thing is, he really does sort of set the bar for what the anti-Austrian view is going to be on something. Okay, what are we looking at here? Where is this? Oh, it's down under history. That, and he's a good writer, and he's pretty clever, and he knows a lot of various facts, and so he can buttress his points with statistics that if you want to make the Austrian claim, you got to deal with Krugman's argument. So that's partly why I'm assigning so much stuff from him, is that I want you guys to understand, you know, what we're going to give the Austrian perspective, but I want you to know what the other side is saying, and Krugman is a good foil for that, since he writes pretty clearly and has written on these issues, and I know his position very well since I read his stuff all the time. Okay, questions for the professor week one. So next week, just to set the stage, next week is going to be the most theoretical of the weeks, because I know some people are asking me about the difficulty of this course. Weeks three and four are going to be kind of like what we did tonight, where I'm just giving you a lot of the basic facts, explaining to you just the various people's positions on things and laying out the Austrian position. Next week, week two, is going to be the most theoretical, so don't get scared off by that one if you find some of the material difficult. But there we're going to look at the history of the, you know, the euro, because remember, the European countries didn't always have a common currency. They used to have their individual fiat currencies. And then it was only fairly recently that they all came under the unified umbrella of the euro. So we're going to look at the history of that, but also the economic theory behind that. Like, what do economists say about how big should a currency area be? You know, should the U.S. have one currency? Should the U.S. and Canada and Mexico all have one currency? Or should each individual U.S. state have its own currency? Like, how do economists deal with that? So we'll go over the standard mainstream view. Like I said, that Paul Krugman did actually a pretty good job of summarizing in the pieces that I gave for you. And then we'll look at what Mises has to say about things like that. Okay, John Chu says, a question on total default. Why is there such hysteria about allowing banks to fail, bondholders to be wiped out, and shareholders of banks to be wiped out as well? If I buy a house for $2 million with $1 million borrowed, then the house price drops to $1 and I sell it to a more astute buyer. The house still exists, money changes hands, and poor capital allocators, I along with the bank, take the hit. The physical asset, the home, still exists to provide shelter. So let the poor capital allocators fail, what's the big deal? I and the bank take a hit, but the new homeowner benefits. The net loss to society would be malinvestment, but price changes would speed up the restructuring of production. Okay, so that's... Hang on, let me just see how many questions we have here. Okay. It's a good question, John. I'm trying to think of how much to answer. So on the one, you're right. I mean, on the one hand, I actually largely agree with you. And that's what I was saying in September of 2008 when Henry Paulson was running around trying to raise, you know, get the public to support TARP. The Fed was started doing its crazy bailout schemes behind the scenes. Other Austrians and I were making the basic point that, look, these bad investments were made. Too many resources flowed into housing, but at this point the damage is done, and the only question now is who's going to bear the brunt of it? Are you going to make the losses fall on the people who made the bad loans and who are sitting on them right now? Or are you going to bail them out and then make the taxpayers as a whole or dollar holders as a whole share the losses? And you're exactly right that, I mean, that's when there's a bankruptcy proceeding, that's what happens. You a certain company, it can't pay all of its bills, you know, so it owes more to creditors than it has in assets. So what do? It declares bankruptcy. The court comes in and says, okay, how do we, what does it have left? What assets does it have? What are the claims on those assets? And then we figure out who gets what, and not everyone's going to get paid 100 cents in the dollar. And that's what you do in bankruptcy. So I think you're right. The claim was that, well, I mean, there are a couple different claims. So some people were just sort of saying, the world would blow up. And they were saying, look, the world did not blow up given what we did. So clearly things are better than they otherwise would have been, because people were convinced if you let all these companies go down, the whole financial system would go down. That wouldn't be this neat, tidy process that you're talking about, or that these Austrians were talking about, of just reallocating the existing thing. They were saying everything would freeze, and that would cause, let me just give you a specific example. We don't have that much time, but let me just give you a specific example. They would say stuff like, look, a particular firm, and this was happening. This isn't a straw man. This was happening. So a particular investment bank, let's say they dabbled really heavily in mortgage-backed securities, and, you know, subprime and all that stuff. So when things started falling apart and more investors realized, uh-oh, the housing bubble is, you know, that was a bubble, it's collapsing. A lot of these people are going to default on their mortgage payments. A lot of these mortgage-backed securities should not have been rated AAA. This is bad news. Then they start looking around for, okay, which financial institutions are sitting on a lot of these things, because they're vulnerable. They start shorting their stocks and what have you, and then other banks refuse to lend to them. So there was that issue where financial institutions got worried. They didn't know who to trust, because they knew some of them were sitting on, you know, the old maid, if you will, if you know that card game. And so they didn't want to lend money to some investment bank and then find out the next day that it was sitting on tons of these mortgage-backed securities and was bankrupt. Okay, so the interbank credit market was freezing up. Another problem was so an investment bank or just any kind of financial hedge fund, whatever, sitting on a lot of these things, they're in trouble, so they need to raise funds. Like, you know, they owe money to people, and normally they would just roll those debts over. So they were engaged in what's called maturity mismatching. So they would borrow money short term from people. You know, so let's say they borrowed money on 30 days, and then, you know, every 30 days they were rolling that thing over, and then they were using it to invest in mortgage-backed securities that were long-term assets. Uh-oh, now it turns out that a lot of those mortgage-backed securities are suspect, and so now when they have to pay off the 30-day loans, they go back to the same type of market and want to get a fresh infusion of a new 30-day loan. And a lot of those people are saying, no, we're not lending to you because we can see you're sitting on these mortgage-backed securities. So what do they have to do? They can try to sell the mortgage-backed securities at a huge loss. And what they were actually doing, though, is they needed to raise money somehow, cash. So they were selling off their actual, the good assets, the things that weren't initially in trouble, because they didn't want to take a huge hit. You know, they couldn't afford to take a huge hit on the stuff that had plummeted in value. So they were selling off good assets to raise money because they couldn't borrow anymore in the short-term market. So then they were just causing a chain of, a cascade effect. So now those good assets, since this is happening to a lot of major firms, the price of those good assets plummets. It's a fire sale. And so then that puts other firms now are vulnerable because they had those assets in their books, and now according to the market price, they're down 20% in a day. And so now they're in trouble. So they have trouble, you know. So it was this sort of cascade chain reaction that was going on, where once a few major players got into trouble and then started doing a fire sale to try to dig out of it, it was just pulling down more and more, and then it just kept getting wider and wider net, bringing down more and more firms. So even firms that had stayed clear of the subprime and even just the real estate market in general, depending on what assets they were holding, they could be in trouble. And so that was part of the argument for we need to nip this in the bud, that this thing is spreading. It's not. So people were saying, look, this is blowing up well out of proportion to a fall in home prices. This doesn't make any sense. A fall in the real estate market should not be getting multiplied 100-fold and threatening to bring down the whole world financial system, which is what a lot of people thought was happening. Another thing, too, John, is given the fractional reserve banking system, the whole system is fragile. Right? That's probably one of the Austrians' arguments against fractional reserve banking is the only way it works is that the public is okay with it, if you have confidence that once people panic, the whole banking system collapses if everyone tries to go and get his money out at the same time. So it doesn't matter how prudently you're running your bank. If the public all of a sudden loses confidence and wants its money back, there's nothing you can do. If you're a fractional reserve banker, you're dead. And so that's another thing going on here is our whole financial system is basically built on a house of cards. And so that's why if there's this major loss of confidence, things can blow up. And why, understandably, some people were saying, we absolutely cannot let that happen. We have to stop that, even if it means governments bailing out irresponsible bankers. Okay. Fortunately, I just got time for one more. Yeah. Okay. So, Stephen, but obviously, for those of you who are new students and never taken a class, where I will answer your questions if I don't get, you know, later on I'll type in the answers because I'm only going to have time to do one more tonight. Okay, Stephen Wise says, could you please explain this sentence from the article regarding Iceland's boom and bust? So this is from the Dave Howden article. So this is a quote. Iceland's crisis is the result of two banking practices that, in combination, proved to be explosive, excessive maturity mismatching and currency mismatching, end quote. So Stephen Wise wants to know what those terms mean. Okay, I'm glad you asked that. I meant to actually mention this in the formal lecture. I forgot. Okay, so maturity mismatching is what I just talked about. That's where you borrow short-term in order to lend or invest long-term. So if you borrow money on a one-year basis, but you invest in assets that will take 10 years to mature, you've engaged in maturity mismatching. And so the danger is, so what might, you know, a yield curve, you guys know what the yield curve is? That's showing in the interest rate, the annualized interest rate, is a function of the maturity of the loan or the bond. Okay, so let's say one-year interest rates are at 1% and five-year interest rates are at 5%. I'm just making those numbers up, obviously. What you can do then, if you think those numbers are going to stay stable, you can make a profit as a bank. You can borrow money at 1%. You can, you know, borrow $1 million at 1%. And then lend it to somebody at 5% for a five-year loan. But just think of what that means. The problem is next year, the guy who lent you the $1 million at 1% is going to show up and say, hey, give me $1.01 million. That's what you owe me. So what you would do at that point is you would go again into the short-term market and borrow $1.01 million. Well, you wouldn't do it. Yeah, and give it to that guy. And then a year later, you'd owe somebody again. You'd borrow from another person, pay off that guy, and you keep doing that. And then after the 5 years, the original guy that you lent the $1 million to pays you back now at the 5% annualized rate. You got a bunch of money. You pay the other person off, and now you've made a tidy profit. Or more realistically, that guy would probably pay you interest all along, and you use that to pay the interest to the short-term borrowers. But the principal, you'd have to keep rolling over. All right? So that works fine, so long as that short-term market doesn't dry up. But if all of a sudden interest rates move, then you're in trouble. If you borrowed at 1% for a year and lent out at 5% for 5 years, and the next year interest rates, even short-term rates, shoot up to 8%, well, now you're in trouble. Or even worse yet, what if you can't get out of the, you know, what if you can't get the loan altogether because your credit rating drops, your credit worthiness drops? And so you have to pay that person his million back, and you're sitting on this thing that's still 4 years away from maturity. and you might have to go out and sell that in the open market, and maybe you're going to take a huge loss on it because interest rates have risen in the meantime. Okay, so that's what maturity mismatching is. So it's a risky game you play. You're hoping interest rates don't move against you, in which case you're hoping that the credit market stays healthy and you can just keep rolling over the short-term debt. And then you make that arbitrage between, you know, the fact that typically longer-term loans have a higher annualized interest rate than shorter-term ones. Currency mismatching means you borrow in one currency and invest in another one. So, so it's the same deal, except it's not necessarily with the time period, now it's the currency. So if interest rates in Japan are really low and they're higher in Ireland, let's say, you could borrow in yen and then switch over and invest in Ireland, right? And so, or, you know, the thing I said with the dollar, you know, you could do it the reverse way that way, right? So if you're borrowing from Japan and investing in Spain, let's say, investing in Spanish real estate. So you borrow in yen, then you take the yen and you convert it to euros, and then you buy Spanish real estate with it, or Spanish bonds or whatever. They're offering a higher interest rate. And that's fine so long as currency exchange rates don't move against you, or that they move in a way that you predicted, you know, because that stuff all gets priced in. But then if there's a surprise and all of a sudden the yen strengthens against the euro, well, now you're in trouble, because even though you may have made more in terms of the nominal interest return on your investment in Spain, when you then have to go and turn those euros back into yen to pay off the loan that you got in Japan that was denominated in yen, you can't do it because the exchange rates moved against you. So that's what, you know, so there's a currency risk there. So that's what he's talking about. So his point was with Iceland, the reason they were in such trouble is a lot of their loans were denominated in foreign currencies. So when the krona fell against these other currencies, all of a sudden, like, the amount of the loan from the point of view of the Icelandic bank zoomed upward. Right, so if you're an American and you have a loan of, you know, you owe a million euros to a bank in Germany, and then the dollar falls 50% against the euro, all of a sudden, like that, to you, your debt just doubled, because now you have to come up with twice as many dollars to convert into 1 million euros as you did before the crash. So that's partly what was going on with Iceland. Why they got into such trouble is their currency, once it started sliding, that made all these debts become that much more severe. Whereas if the Icelandic banks, if their debts had been denominated in their own currency, yeah, they were still indebted, but the movement of their currency wouldn't have been a, you know, stake in the heart. Okay, so I'll stop there. And again, your quiz will be posted by Friday. I'll send you an email tomorrow with that, and I'll catch up with any of the loose ends. So for next week in particular, more than any of the other weeks, if you do the reading beforehand, it's going to help you, since some of you may not be familiar with any of these concepts. Okay, thanks, everybody.